This week's Undisclosed Addendum is brought to you by two great sponsors. They include Time, the Khalif Browder story, only on Spike TV, and Squarespace. Build it beautiful with Squarespace. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In episode 4 of the Jamar Huggins arc, I discussed the jury's verdict convicting him of burglary, armed robbery, and kidnapping. Some of you were left wondering how he was convicted of kidnapping, which takes us to the first topic for today's addendum. Part 1, kidnapping. Let's start this section with a question from Taylor. Her Twitter handle is @SchmalerSchmay, and she asks, just got to episode 3, he was charged with kidnapping, did I miss something? This is a great question, and it's the same question that Jamar's mother asked me when I spoke to her.
I want to know, is some stuff in his case where the woman said that they were kidnapped? How they got kidnapped when they never left the house?
To answer this question, let's look at South Carolina's kidnapping statute, which is contained in section 16.3.9.10 of the South Carolina Code. In pertinent part, it states that whoever shall unlawfully seize, confine, inveigle, decoy, kidnap, abduct, or carry away any other person by any means whatsoever without authority of law is guilty of kidnapping. Now, the carrying away portion of kidnapping involves a legal concept known as asportation. And somewhat controversially, courts have found that even a slight carrying away satisfies this asportation requirement. So in the Jamar Huggins case, the perpetrators forcefully moving Eckler and her daughter from the bedroom to the bathroom satisfied this asportation requirement and allowed for a kidnapping conviction. Georgia actually applies a similar definition of kidnapping, and in Curtis v. State, the Court of Appeals of Georgia dealt with a very similar fact pattern. And in the opinion, it concluded that Curtis's act of dragging the victim by her hair inside the house was sufficient evidence of asportation to support his conviction. The movement was not merely a criminologically insignificant circumstance attendant to some other crime, but rather was representative of the evil that the kidnapping statute was designed to address. And what that means is in both Georgia and South Carolina, if you have a burglary, there's no requirement you actually remove the occupants of the home from the house to be guilty of kidnapping. Simply moving them from one room to another within the house qualifies the defendant for a kidnapping conviction. Part 2, wrongful conviction compensation statutes. In episode 4, I raised the possibility that Jamar's convictions might be reversed on appeal based upon one or more issues. And if that's the case, the question is, would he be entitled to any type of compensation based upon a wrongful conviction? In the first addendum, I played part of my interview with Chelsea Evans, a student at the University of South Carolina School of Law, who has written on this subject for her student note. Since our interview, Chelsea's note was actually selected for publication, and she was also elected as the first African-American editor-in-chief of the University of South Carolina Law Review. One interesting thing that Chelsea found in her research was that the wrongfully convicted are in some ways treated worse than those who were rightfully convicted and served their sentences.
But generally, some exonerees across the country have run into issues where when they're exonerated and they get out of prison, you know, these people come out and they pretty much have, you know, if they don't have family or some type of support system, they pretty much have nowhere to go. They're just on their own. And so many people, when they're, you know, released from prison after serving their time, or if they're out on parole, the state normally has a lot of services to help these folks reintegrate into society. And what some of the wrongfully convicted exonerees are finding out is that once they are released, these services aren't available to them because they're technically not ex-felons. They, you know, they technically didn't commit any crimes, and so they're being shut out of some of these services and not able to access those.
I followed up on this by asking Chelsea about the difficulty that exonerees have reintegrating back into society, and she noted how the difficulties affect essentially every aspect of an exoneree's life.
A lot of these people, when they come out of prison, they experience really just issues accessing very basic resources such as housing, employment, healthcare needs, and you know, just access to financial capital, just period. And so one of the issues that kind of, you know, leads to all these other issues is employment. That's a huge, huge issue. And so people come out and, you know, they go to apply for jobs, but a lot of times they haven't had their record expunged for whatever reason. Normally, it's an access issue. A lot of times you need a lawyer to get through the expungement process, and a lot of these people are coming out and they just do not have the resources to go engage a lawyer for that. So they go, they try to apply for a job, and then, you know, the employer runs a standard background check, or, you know, they have to check the box and basically say, you know, have you been convicted of a felony? And, you know, after that, it's a whole having to explain to the employer, well, yeah, I went to prison, I was convicted, but I was actually innocent. So, you know, I think a lot of people get shut out of, you know, potential employment prospects because of that. And then also there's a stigma issue as well. A lot of employers will have these people come in and, you know, they hear their story, but a lot of times, you know, especially in smaller, tight-knit communities, a lot of people have already heard of the case, they've followed the case, they've already kind of formed their own opinions about whether this person is guilty or not. They worry about what their, you know, clients or what their customers will think, and what the other, you know, employees will think. And I think that also contributes to, you know, basically shutting these people out of work. And then additionally, people have issues with having the requisite skills. A lot of these people, you know, depending on when they went in, it's really unfortunate. So many of them went in, you know, in the 80s or 90s or maybe before that. And technology has really been a game changer these last couple of years. And they just, some of these guys I read where, you know, they don't know how to operate a cell phone. They don't know how to operate an ATM card. They've never really had, you know, much experience with these things. And that's not everyone, but some people have had those challenges as well. And then also part of the skills issue is, you know, they just haven't, a lot of these people went away when they were very young and never actually developed a job skill set. So even if they find an employer that's willing to take a chance and hire them, they're still, you know, unable to get employed because they don't have the skills. Another issue that these folks are dealing with is obtaining housing. And I read somewhere that homelessness is not uncommon for exonerees. A lot of this stems from not being able to get employed, and if you don't have a support system or someone to live with, you really don't have money. And so a lot of, you know, landlords are going to, you know, also run a background check, also see the criminal record and, you know, have questions and concerns about that and not really want to, you know, give housing to these folks. And then, you know, also looking at credit histories, landlords love to see those. And if they see that you haven't really built credit because you were in prison, they're also not likely to want to rent to you. And then there's also, again, just the initial cost. There's a lot of, you know, security deposits and rent and things like that. And a lot of these folks just don't have the means when they're, you know, initially released from prison. And then also, a lot of these folks deal with healthcare issues. Prison conditions can be not the best, and a lot of these people come out with chronic diseases that, you know, they developed while they were in prison, or they just got worse while they were in prison, and they need health care and medicine and things like that, and they're unable to access that because they can't get insurance. Again, because they likely aren't employed, and most people get insurance through being employed. And then a lot of these people are also dealing with the trauma of being in prison, and there's a lot of, you know, mental effects from being incarcerated, and that's true across the board for pretty much any one who has served, you know, a significant amount of time in prison, but I'm sure it is magnified even more for exonerees because they knew they were innocent. I think there's definitely, you know, psychological effect of having to sit in prison and know that you should not have been there in the first place.
This then takes us to the heart of Chelsea's paper. 32 states and the federal government have wrongful conviction compensation statutes. These are statutes where an exoneree can apply for compensation and automatically receive it if you meet certain statutory criteria. In the absence of such a statute, exonerees are left with two options. The first is a lawsuit.
So there's two main ways that people seek compensation if a state does not have some type of statutory scheme to provide compensation. And the first is a federal 1983 civil rights claim, essentially. And most people, essentially what they do is sue the state and say, you know, I was wrongfully convicted and incarcerated. And this could lead to some really good outcomes for these folks, but a lot of times they run into issues with immunity issues regarding who they can actually sue. And then they also run into issues of having to basically show that the state did something wrong. Some people come out and, you know, they weren't exonerated or released because the state did something wrong. It could have been a situation where, you know, there was an informant who basically initially lied and said that they did something and then came back and recanted their testimony. In that situation, the state didn't do anything wrong, and therefore you wouldn't be able to sue the state for wrongdoing because they didn't do anything wrong. And another issue before even getting to the actual litigation process is securing a lawyer. And many folks are not going to be able to go hire a lawyer and pay for the lawyer to actually bring this lawsuit. And then, you know, similar to that is the issue of a lot of these people don't even want to deal with the legal process. You know, I personally can't blame them after they've, you know, basically been victimized by the system. They really aren't interested in dealing with lawyers and the court system anymore. And, you know, that's one reason I think the statutory compensation is a superior system, is because, you know, if it's structured properly, you likely wouldn't have to spend that much time in court again.
That leaves the second option, which is known as a private bill.
Essentially what that is special legislation where an exoneree would find a legislator that was sympathetic to their cause and basically get this legislator to introduce a bill. And the bill would basically benefit just this particular exoneree and, you know, go through the legislative process. And, you know, that can be a great thing if you can find someone who's willing to champion your cause. But many times these folks just do not have the political capital to go find a legislator that's willing to do that for them. Unless it's, you know, a very high profile case where someone is really moved by it and really wants to champion the cause, it seems like this is not the best way to try to achieve compensation.
As a result, Chelsea has proposed that South Carolina should pass a wrongful conviction compensation statute. And what she found in her research was that states have significant differences in their statutes. They differ on the statute of limitations to recover, they differ on the burden of proof for proving actual innocence, and maybe most significantly, they differ on the amount of compensation that an exoneree can receive per year of wrongful conviction.
Yeah, I guess maybe the crux of the issue is the amount. These statutes vary tremendously on how much money the state is willing to pay out for the claim. Some states, I believe Wisconsin, it's as low as $5,000 a year for every year that you were incarcerated, and then that goes all the way up to $80,000 a year in Texas, which has really been an extremely progressive state and what they're trying to do for the wrongfully convicted. Several states are kind of right there in the middle at the $50,000 range, including the federal government, but it varies all in between that scale.
But whatever the amount, Chelsea and I are going to get our article to legislators in South Carolina, and the hope is that a bill is introduced in the near future and that we soon join the 32 other states with wrongful conviction compensation statutes. I'll keep you updated on the effort. Make your next move with Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template. Squarespace award-winning templates are the easiest way to present your ideas online. You can create a fantastic-looking and easy-to-navigate website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. And Squarespace provides award-winning 24/7 customer support. Squarespace offers a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and simple to set up. And Squarespace is used by a wide range of creatives, people, and businesses, including musicians, designers, artists, restaurants, and more. And now, Undisclosed listeners, you can get 10% off of any website subscription or domain purchase by going to squarespace.com and using the promo code Undisclosed. Make your next move with Squarespace. Part 3, Jury Selection and Ineffective Assistance of Counsel. I'm going to start this section by reading a Twitter question from Michael Eckstut. His Twitter handle is @veryeckstut, and he asks, more info on the recused juror. When in the trial was she dismissed? Might it help explain the conviction? Now, Michael is asking about the young African-American female juror who was excused from the Jamar Huggins case after saying it had too much street. She asked to be dismissed from the case during jury selection before either side had exercised their jury challenges. In terms of whether her dismissal explains the conviction, the answer is it's complicated. Jury veneers are created in most jurisdictions based on some combination of census data, driver's license records, and voting registries, and many studies have found that this leads to the underrepresentation of minorities, women, the young, and the old. Then, after the veneer is created, prospective jurors in these categories disproportionately ask to be dismissed from jury duty. And finally, based on the use of jury challenges, prospective jurors in these categories are also struck at disproportionate rates. This disproportionality is most pronounced in capital cases where the death penalty is on the table. I recently moderated a panel on the death penalty for the South Carolina Law Review Symposium, and Annie Eisenberg, my colleague at the University of South Carolina School of Law, presented a paper on her research regarding the use of jury strikes in capital cases in South Carolina.
So my co-authors and my study for this symposium looked at 20 capital trials in South Carolina from 1997 to the present, for which we had complete data from the beginning of voir dire to the end of the peremptory strike stage on prospective jurors' race and gender. And we asked whether, and if so, why, women and African Americans were removed at disproportionate rates from the jury. This is not comprehensive data for all of South Carolina. It's not a simple random sample. The study is very limited in its generalizability. But it was interesting that even this small study, the findings have been consistent with findings that have been produced over and over again for 40 years. So the prosecution struck 29% of strike-eligible black potential jurors compared to 12.5% of strike-eligible white potential jurors. Other studies have controlled for race-neutral factors, and when they've controlled for race-neutral factors to examine those strike rates, the disparities have persisted. So we weren't able to control for that here, but because it's so similar to previous studies' findings, I think it's reasonable to conclude race was a factor in the party's use of their strikes, and that's a problem. But to me, the most striking conclusion from this study was the combined effects of the death qualification process plus the peremptory strike phase. When you put those together and looked at the combined effects on the overall pool of potential African American jurors, that accounted for getting rid of 42% of them compared to 13% of white potential jurors.
Studies have shown that underrepresentation of minority jurors tends to lead to higher conviction rates and a higher chance of the death penalty being imposed, especially in cases of minority defendants and especially in cases of minority defendants and Caucasian victims. One case where this occurred was in the prosecution of Edward Lee Elmore, an African-American man from South Carolina who was given a death sentence before his conviction was thrown out in appeal. His attorney, Diana Hull, also spoke at the symposium, and here's her doing three things. First, playing the audio from oral arguments before the Fourth Circuit, which threw out Elmore's conviction. Second, discussing what thereafter happened. And third, introducing a special guest.
Don't you think that would make a difference in the trial? They had known that some white person was on the scene, leaving their bodily hair on her stomach.
No, I don't.
You don't think so? Because it was on the jury there, that place wouldn't have made any difference for trying this man. That wouldn't have made any difference.
Yay! We got some justice. And even that little bit where there's that exchange and the government's being called on the carpet for what are you talking about? How that wouldn't make a difference. It was on her body. That's the evidence that counts the most in a murder scene. 14 months go by, the Fourth Circuit comes down and says, reverses everything, reverses, grants him a whole new trial. All sentences are gone. The district court refused to stay the matter that the government was requesting they could go through cert. This is a real live, breathing, wrongful conviction who spent 28 years on death row.
Now, the Elmore case allows me to take a brief detour to the Adnan Syed case from our first season. On Monday, the state filed its appellate brief seeking a reversal of Judge Welch's order granting Adnan a new trial based upon his trial attorney failing to properly cross-examine the state's cell tower expert. In its brief this Monday, the state cited a Georgia case for the proposition that decisions regarding cross-examination are usually matters of trial strategy and not grounds for a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel. But the Elmore case is actually out of the Fourth Circuit, which covers Maryland, and the court specifically held that effective cross-examination of experts is essential where expert evidence is key to the case. Specifically, in the Elmore case, the court found that forensic evidence was always and obviously vital to the state's case, which otherwise relied upon James Gilliam's account of Elmore's spontaneous jailhouse confession and Elmore's guilty demeanor and lack of a corroborated alibi for Saturday night. As such, the defense did not risk making a central issue out of the forensic evidence because the state was already certain to do so. Rather, the circumstances necessitated that the defense work to engender doubt about the forensic evidence. Elmore's lawyers attempted as much in their cross-examination of the state's witnesses, but because the lawyers had twice squandered opportunities to investigate the forensic evidence prior to the 1982 and 1984 trials, they were unarmed for the battle. This language sounds like it could have been written about Christina Gutierrez in the Adnan Syed case, trying to cross-examine the state's cell tower expert but coming in unarmed based upon her own admission of lack of preparation. And given that Judge Welch found the cell tower pings were part of the crux of the state's case against Adnan, the Fourth Circuit decision that made Eddie Elmore a free man might just lead to the same result for Adnan. March 1st at 10 p.m. on Spike, from executive producers Sean J.Z. Carter and Harvey Weinstein, comes the groundbreaking six-part documentary event series Time, The Khalif Browder Story. Browder was a 16-year-old African-American high school student from the Bronx, walking home from a party when he was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He then spent an unthinkable 3 years on Rikers Island, 2 of those years in solitary confinement, all without ever being convicted of a crime. The series uses first-person accounts, unprecedented archival footage, and interviews with politicians, friends, and family, all to take a comprehensive look at Khalif's life and how his legacy shines a light on the inequalities inside the criminal justice system. According to Jay-Z, Khalif Browder is a modern-day prophet, his story of failure of the judicial process. Time recently premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, where it had a profound impact on audience members. Variety calls Time an important contribution to the true crime documentary genre, and that what sets it apart is that you can see many of the violations of Browder and other young men happening right before your eyes inside Rikers. The Daily Beast says it's the best documentary coming out of Sundance, and maybe this year's OJ Made in America, and Revolt TV called it captivating. And I can say, if you've been listening to Undisclosed, this is absolutely must-watch TV. So that's Time, The Khalif Browder Story, and it premieres March 1st at 10 p.m. on Spike. Part 4, Social Media Questions. This first question comes from Benjamin Bruning. His Twitter handle is @BGBruning, and he asks, banging head against the wall moment. A witness recantation is not considered reliable. Yeah, this is my main issue with South Carolina's law, which is it says essentially if you've been convicted and a key witness against you at trial recants, that recantation is unreliable and ordinarily is insufficient to have your conviction thrown out. But that being the case, when the only witness against you at trial is saying you weren't involved and the only evidence that you were involved is their prior inconsistent statement, how standing alone is that prior inconsistent statement not under oath sufficient to prove guilt? Why is that testimony at trial unreliable, but the prior statement is enough to prove guilt? And that's why I would say at a minimum, a state like South Carolina should follow the approach of states like Delaware. Delaware does allow for a conviction based upon a recanted prior inconsistent statement, but only if that statement is proven to be reliable based upon other corroborating evidence. In South Carolina, that prior inconsistent statement standing alone is enough, but if that's the case, then a recantation after trial should get the same treatment, and therefore, in a case like the Jamar Huggins case, I think you should have pretty easily that conviction being thrown out when D'Angelo Montgomery says after trial, he wasn't involved, and here's the guy who was involved. The second question comes from Michelle, and her Twitter handle is @AmigaDeHelado, and she asks, what is Jamar's best chance for release, and do you agree with lawyer's assessment of solicitor? In terms of defense counsel Natasha Hanna's assessment of solicitor Jimmy Richardson, I haven't had any direct dealings with him. I've had a few calls with his office to try to get him to go on the record, and understandably, he's not willing at this point to go on the record. I have, though, talked to people who are both defense attorneys and prosecutors, solicitors in South Carolina, and they all speak very highly of him, and that speaks well to hopefully there being a swift resolution in this case. In terms of if Jimmy Richardson does not drop the charges and these appeals go forward, I think still at this point the best avenue for relief for Jamar is what his attorney Natasha Hanna has found, and that is the new statement by D'Angelo Montgomery where she says it was not Jamar, he had no idea his car was being used in the crime, and I can name Mr. K as the person involved. And of course, I've played for you previously in the episodes her prison phone call where she said that Mr. K is the person who had the laptop of Adrian Moore and that he was the one who came to her house and then eventually they committed the burglary. And there's other evidence in the record tending to point to Mr. K. So it's not finalized yet, the appeal, as Natasha noted, but I think with the evidence they have and just a little bit more evidence, there's going to be enough there for Judge Culbertson to find Jamar should be entitled to a new trial. This third question comes from Katie Kronk. Her Twitter handle is @KatieKronk, and she asks, was there any reason to not speak with the family about that night? Was it simply missed or legal strategy? Yeah, and as I noted in the episode, this is really the key question in terms of a PCR petition for Jamar. Certainly, Jamar's mother Helen and her friend Jeanette are adamant they saw Jamar at home at the time of this burglary, and they were never contacted by defense counsel. As I noted, trial counsel John Long was not able to comment on the issue, and we'll have to see. I mean, this will be, in essence, what that appeal comes down to is what his attorney says about why there was no contact between him and the mother and Jeanette, and depending upon his response there, that would either be an avenue for relief or a door that's shut in this case. These next Twitter questions come from Kiki, and her Twitter handle is @KidScientist, and she asks, was there ever an in-person lineup? Seems the witness knew the minute she saw Jamar that he was not the one, half the size, 280 versus 140 pounds, long dreads, not short, things in a lineup she'd have seen. And the answer to this question is no. There was never an in-person lineup where D'Angelo Montgomery identified Jamar Huggins. There was simply his photo being shown to her after her initial police interrogation by Detective Martin. And of course, as I noted at trial, D'Angelo Montgomery says Detective Martin had already circled Jamar's photo before she was asked to make the identification. I can't say whether that happened or not, but what I can say is there was never an in-person lineup that was done. And exactly, when she walked into the courtroom, she was absolutely consistent on the stand. This is definitely not the person who was involved in this burglary. This next question comes from Christy O'Reilly. Her Twitter handle is @ChrisO'Reilly, and she asks, what is the likely timescales for Jamar getting out, if at all possible? The answer is there are a couple of possibilities here. I know that Jamar's sister, Denedra, has sent along episodes of my podcast to Jimmy Richardson. If he listens to those and is satisfied of Jamar's innocence, it's possible tomorrow, next week, next month, he could decide this was a wrongful conviction and I'm going to drop the case against Jamar and I'm not going to fight him being released. The second possibility is Natasha's motion for a new trial. As we mentioned in episode 4, she already has some pretty strong evidence. The statement of D'Angelo Montgomery that Mr. K was involved and not Jamar. She's out there exploring a few new avenues, and she might be done in a week, a month, a couple months, but it probably won't be too long before that motion is heard before Judge Culbertson, and that could fairly swiftly lead to release. The other option, as I mentioned, is the PCR, the petition for post-conviction relief. That probably would be a bit of a longer timeline, and the state might dig their heels in on that one a little bit more. So for the PCR, if that's the ultimate avenue of relief, we're probably talking more in the half a year to a year range before Jamar would be released. This next question comes from Sarah Spence, and her Twitter handle is @SarahSpence17, and she asks, what are the next steps in the Jamar Huggins case? And following up on my previous response, right now, Natasha has filed the motion for a new trial. She filed that last fall, and then she asked for a continuance, meaning essentially she hit the pause button as she gathers additional evidence. The next step on that motion is when she is satisfied she has gathered as much evidence as she needs, she would then move to lift the continuance. A date would be scheduled to hear her motion, and at that point we would hear arguments from both sides, and the judge, probably in relatively short order after the hearing, would have a decision one way or the other. In terms of PCR, that still has not been filed yet, and so that is something where, looking at these issues, ineffective assistance, etc., that probably in the next month or so would be filed, and then a court date would be established to hear the petition for post-conviction relief. This next question comes from Dave Howarth. His Twitter handle is @DaveHoworth. And he asks, Jamar's lawyer said he sees where he could have done things differently. Do you think in the moment that he missed something, or would the case have been in the bag for you as well in the moment? Yeah, you know, it's a really tough question to answer. As you saw in my interview of John Long, his philosophy was really the only witness against Jamar recanted at trial, and he wanted to keep it simple because opening up other doors could have helped the defense in some way, but it also risked complicating matters when he had pretty clear evidence of innocence. If there's one thing I'm looking at the case, what I might have tried to admit is, as I noted before, they got the phone records for Adrian Moore. The contention here was that Adrian Moore was constantly buying drugs from Jamar, and those phone records showed no text messages or phone calls to or from Jamar. And I would have tried, I think, in that case, to have the exhibit admitted of the cell phone records to show no contact between the two. I think that would have bolstered the defense case. But again, it's really tough to say without being there in the courtroom and seeing what's going on exactly what I might have done differently. This next question comes from Tara Harrison. Her Twitter handle is @Tara27H, and she asks, what recourse does Jay have, and any response to request for pro bono representation? Yeah, and the answer to this is I had a person in South Carolina reach out to me and say I'm possibly interested in assisting pro bono on Jamar's appeal. And so I'm currently in the process of talking with the family and seeing exactly what they want to pursue. So it's not 100% yet, but I do have a very kind person who has stepped up and said I might be able to help, and I will keep you updated on the status of that PCR appeal. This next question comes from Brooke. Her Twitter handle is @BrookePodJunkie, and she asks, do you know if the victim is shown a photo of Mr. K from the time the crime occurred to see if she can identify him now? And the answer to this is no. Angela Eckler was never shown a photo of Mr. K, and I believe that is something that Natasha is looking into to show her a photo and see if she can identify him as either the person who stopped by earlier in the day or is involved in the burglary. And yeah, absolutely. If she could make a positive identification of Mr. K, that would certainly bolster Jamar's claim that he is entitled to a new trial. This next question is a Facebook question from Alexander Henderson, and he asks, in a especially odd application of precedent, State versus Whitener dealt with a recantation after trial, and importantly, not under oath, while this deals with a recantation when under oath of a statement made before trial when not. If anything, I would think the precedent should lead one to believe that the statement made under oath should be taken as more reliable, unless by strict scrutiny it can be determined otherwise. Yeah, I 100% agree with Alexander, and that's why I noted on episode 4 and Natasha noted as well, we don't think this is a case that should be covered by the Whitener precedent for exactly the reason that Alexander noted, and that is that Whitener and other cases are all about, as I said, legal inertia. Courts don't want to disturb statements that are given under oath, but in this case, D'Angelo Montgomery, under oath, consistently said Jamar is not involved, and that's why I think that when Natasha's motion is heard by Judge Culbertson, there's a great argument that these precedents do not deny relief to Jamar, and that in fact, in this case, under oath and after trial, D'Angela Montgomery is consistently saying Jamar is not involved, and now we have the additional evidence where she's saying it was in fact Mr. K, an alternate suspect, and we have other corroborating evidence, and hopefully soon even more corroborating evidence that tends to show he was the one involved and not Jamar. This final question is an Instagram question. It comes from @TedWatts, and he says, the idea that prosecutors might prefer their eyewitness to recant their testimony because then they cannot be cross-examined about it in court is chilling. So why did the issue of the admissibility of prior inconsistent statement from the eyewitness not get brought up on direct appeal? Could this be ineffective assistance of counsel? Yeah, and so the prior question led to my discussion of how Jamar's current appeal and motion for a new trial has a decent chance of success based upon prior precedent not controlling. And Ted's question shows why his PCR petition might very well be successful as well. And that's because, yes, in South Carolina, like many other jurisdictions, a defendant can claim ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel. And I sort of laid this out a bit in the episode, but right, the point here is this. D'Angela Montgomery at trial said, Jamar is not junk. He was not the one involved in the burglary. She did acknowledge making a prior statement where she said junk was involved in the crime. But notably at trial, the prosecution did not lay a proper foundation for D'Angela Montgomery's identification of Jamar as junk into evidence. And what that means is an argument that could have been made in appeal was the directed verdict motion should have been granted because there was no evidence on the record at trial that Jamar was junk, and without any evidence on the record that Jamar was junk, there was not evidence from which a jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Thanks so much for listening to this series of episodes about the Jamar Huggins case. I can promise you I'll continue to work on this case and report back to you both in my blog and the podcast. If you want to make a contribution to Jamar's legal defense fund, you can do so by going to www.fundedjustice.com/JamarHuggins. In terms of upcoming content and undisclosed, next Monday, Robbie and her team will start a series of episodes on the death of Freddie Gray. In terms of today's addendum, I'd like to thank the following people. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Muster for website management, Baluki for our logo, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. This season's addendum theme was written by Ramiro Marquez, performed by Mark Augustin, and produced by Patrick Cortez. Some of the music you heard throughout this episode and the credit song comes from Ward Dunn and his South Carolina band Pluto Wilson. You can get their music at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod. And finally, in 2017, the University of South Carolina School of Law celebrates 150 years of contributing to the common good through a hands-on approach to legal education, leading to a cutting-edge understanding and application of the law. The School of Law will also move to its new state-of-the-art home this summer, built with the needs of today's students in mind. We've made National Jurist Magazine's Best Value Law School for 8 years in a row, and were named a top 50 go-to law school by the National Law Journal in 2016. If Undisclosed has inspired your interest to study the law, we encourage you to start your journey toward a legal career by visiting the University of South Carolina School of Law at law.sc.edu. Today, nothing left to lose.